Let's do this.
So both the 9 o'clock service and a number of you want to know what I think happens after we die. I don't think anything happens after we die. I think we return to the form from whence we came. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And I do, I truly believe that. And I think that that is miraculous in and of itself, that we return, we degrade, and become back to the way we were originally, atoms and molecules and hydrogen and carbon. I think that's beautiful. I don't think I need more than that to explain the next step. And that's not to say I don't find a lot of meaning and power in concepts of heaven or the afterlife or reincarnation. As I said earlier, I'm not in the business of depriving people of comfort, and I have seen the profound comfort that those things can bring people. The notion that we, again, or the notion that there is more beyond this life, I think those are really beautiful and deep ideas. That's just not what I think. And I think that we do live on. I think we live on in the hearts of the people that we touched. I think we live on in memories, in the stories about us. And I think that other people that have passed live with us. In the way we are with other people, in the ways that we were affected by our relationships with those who have died. So in that sense, I do believe that you live beyond your physical form. But after we die, I think we just go back to the earth. Are you a vegetarian? Why or why not? I'm not a vegetarian. I have been. I've dabbled. I think of meat as a vice, and I would encourage others to think of it that way too. The same way we think about drinking or drugs or smoking, I think meat is a vice. I think it's really damaging to the environment. I think it's potentially really terrible for the animals. And I mean that not even in the sense that we're ending their life, but industrialized farming is horrific. No, and to be honest, I don't make a ton of money, but I try and spend it on meat that was raised in a humane way, because this sounds very Buddhist of me, but I don't want to ingest that animal's suffering. I really don't. I believe that. I believe that if you eat the meat of an animal that was scared and sick and tortured its whole life, that is in you now. And I don't want that. I want to eat an animal. If I'm going to eat an animal, if I'm going to indulge in that vice, I want it to have lived a life worthy of a pigness, of cowness, the way it was intended to live. But I'm not a vegetarian. And this kind of leads into another question many of you had, which is how I relax. So I do have vices. I'm not a saint. I like bacon. So yeah, a number of you asked how I relax, what I do when I'm not at church. I watch a lot of television. Like a lot of television. And I always have. I have always been a person who really enjoyed television and movies. And one of the ways I stay inspired in ministry is I consume a lot. I read a lot. I read a lot of long-form journalism. I read a lot of news. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of poetry. I listen to the radio. I listen to podcasts. I watch a lot of movies. I watch a lot of TV. I am constantly trying to stay inspired by what is being generated by other people. I go to museums a lot. I go to talks a lot. I go to concerts a lot. And that's how I relax, is kind of staying in touch with learning, staying in touch with growing, with new ideas, even ideas I don't like or I don't agree with, just staying open to new things. And then a lot of it is escapism, too. I love trashy television. I love some reality television. I try to be mindful and very choiceful about how much and what it is that I watch. But, yeah, that's how I relax. Oh, and I work out a lot. I find it really good for my mental health. Yeah. Has your personal journey or training as a UU minister involved a study of the Bible? What is your view of the Bible? Yeah, I went to Union Theological Seminary, which is a non-denominational seminary in New York City. It's also where Kim went. It is not a UU seminary. I went to seminary for 3 years with a lot of people who know the Bible way better than I do, than I did. And that was a gift. I learned a lot about the Bible in school. I took a semester of Old Testament. I took a semester of New Testament. I took a year on exegesis, which is where you learn how to interpret the word of the Bible to preach it. I took a semester on Paul's letter to the Romans, which was dry. And in general, Union is steeped in people who are people of the book. So they are going out to pursue professional ministries preaching from the Bible. So I heard a lot more about it. What do I think of the Bible? I think the Bible is a living document. I think that as translations change, new truths are revealed. I think that as context changes, so does the meaning of the Bible. I think that it is not the word of God. I think it is the word of the people. I think it is Christianity's book of mythology. I think it is meaningful and full of stories that relate to our present day, particularly the story of Exodus, stories of liberation. I think particularly in the New Testament, Jesus was a radical figure. Very radical. He was about upending the power structure, the status quo. If you really believed what Jesus believed, I mean, you wouldn't bank at a commercial bank. You wouldn't save money. You'd spend it on the poor. You'd have very little belongings. He preached a really radical notion that I think is inspiring and true today. So that's what I think of the Bible. How do you avoid internalizing the suffering of a loved one when their pain leaves you miserable and guilty about your own happiness? So a coping mechanism I learned when I did CPE, which is clinical pastoral education. It's required for Unitarian Universalist ministers to spend a summer intensive working at a hospital or in a nursing home. I worked at a hospital. And those days are hard, right? You're visiting people who are in the hospital, who are dying or heading into surgery or in the midst of long and arduous fights. And I learned to make little rituals for myself when I left, to sort of compartmentalize and to move into a different place of being. So one was I listened to certain music and I would turn it up really loud and I would put all the windows down and I would sing as loud as I could. I find singing to be really cathartic. I find it can really take me out of myself, and when I'm done, I feel better. I also talked to people. I made a ritual of I called my mom, my dad, or my sister when I was leaving, and I would just tell them about my day. I told them about who I saw and what I experienced and how I was feeling. And again, I guess I'm really into catharsis because it sort of feels like I'm taking it out and putting it out into the world, and it doesn't reside in me anymore. So I think that's a really great way to not internalize the suffering of others that you're trying to help. In terms of guilt about your own happiness, I do not believe that guilt is a helpful emotion. I don't think that guilt is helpful really in any context. I think it's something that you should acknowledge that you feel and then work to move through it to whatever is next after guilt. And I think I rest on the idea, on the truth, that bad things happen to good people. And so knowing that that is true, and that that person is not alone in their suffering. Not only are they not alone because I'm with them, but they're not alone because lots of good people suffer. Without cause, without reason, without justification. And then I try to turn guilt to gratitude. I try to pivot from guilt to gratitude. How lucky am I that I feel happiness? How lucky am I that light has shone on my life, continues to shine on my life? And to not sit in guilt for too long, because I don't think guilt serves the other person either. How do you intentionally engage and support the LGBT community? I'm gay. You guys may not know that. Maybe you know that. Well, actually, some days I wake up and I feel gay, and some days I wake up and I feel not straight. And I am hoping that for any queer people in the room, they can relate to that feeling. Sometimes it's not always clear cut every day when you wake up. So how do I engage in the... Well, I have a lot of gay friends. I have a lot of queer friends. And I try to have friends who don't fit neatly into boxes with their sexual identity, because I do think that that is how to engage and support the LGBTQ community, is to not silo myself. I don't only hang out with lesbians, cisgendered women who love other cisgendered women. I don't only hang out with bisexual people. I don't only hang out with gay men. I think that's really embracing the breadth and the spectrum of what it means to be not straight. I think that's a great way to engage. Supporting the LGBT community. I give away little bits of money. I realized recently that I don't really have very deliberate or conscientious acts of philanthropy. I don't really have enough money to do that. But what I do is, like, friends from Union, two black queer women that I'm friends with from Union, were hosting a space in New York for other queer people of color to come hang out and just be together. And I Venmo'd them $25. They asked for support from people who are allies in the community. I Venmo'd them $25. My friend Ian in North Carolina is working with young queer people to reinterpret the Bible, and he's hosting a youth group for queer Christian youth. I sent him $15. Not large sums of money, small sums of money, but it feels like I'm doing something. And then, the last thing is that I'm out. I'm out and proud. That is really, I'm not in the closet with anyone. And I also, to be quite frank, I don't lead with it either. I'm more than just a gay person. That is not the only thing about me. And I try and live my life as I would always live it, without a whole lot of hesitation. I would say that has gotten harder since Trump was elected. My partner is very masculine presenting, and I get really scared now when we go to gas stations or when we go to rest stops and she goes to the bathroom. I get nervous sometimes when we're in public about leaving her alone. And that didn't used to happen. And I don't necessarily think that that's Trump related. I think some of that is about me getting older and more aware, and also that I have so much invested in this person I love, and I am scared that anything might happen to her. But yeah. So it's not all sunny all the time. As a white minister and the acknowledgement of UU being a white-centered faith, what and how do you see us moving forward to be more inclusive truly to people of color? I think one of the biggest things that needs to happen is there need to be more ministers of color. I think that white congregations need to be led by people of color. I think that white congregations need to open their hearts and their minds to the authority and the leadership and the vision that rests with ministers of color. I think that there needs to be something of a truth and reconciliation process within Unitarian Universalism. I think that people of color who have been UUs for a long time or are thinking about it and have been on the receiving end of terrible things need to have the space to make that known and to be met with an apology. I think that we have a lot of apologizing to do, frankly. I think, you know, we have a long as a denomination. I think a lot of people don't always know that. I'm looking at Charlie, long time. Long time UU. But, you know, all the way back to the 1800s, we revoked the first black man who tried to hold a pulpit as a Unitarian. We revoked his fellowship. I don't think it's going to work for you. In the 60s and the 50s, we said we were going to fund essentially what was Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism back then, and we backed off. We put all this work and energy into voting that we were going to give them $1 million, and then we sort of said, we'll give you $250,000. And actually, we're going to give you $250,000, we're going to spread it out over many years. And that's institutional racism. It looks like, we can't come up with it. Our cash is strapped, but it's choosing to prioritize certain things over other things. So I think leadership, I think truth and reconciliation process, and I think that white people need to spend a lot more time cultivating self-awareness. I think that cultivating self-awareness is a spiritual practice. I spend a lot of time reflecting on how it is that I am in the world. How is it that I have treated other people? What has their face said when I've said the things that I have said? How has their body reacted when I have said the things that I have said? And questioning myself, why is that my reaction? Why is that my impulse? This cultivating self-awareness, I think, is so important for white people, because we are programmed to be racist. We are programmed from utero, and it takes work to deprogram oneself. It takes constant reflection, constant cultivation of self-awareness, and a commitment to messing up sometimes and staying in it. Because whatever discomfort you feel, whatever pain you might feel in that moment when you stepped on someone's toes, it is minute, it is microscopic compared to the pain and marginalization and minimization of the experience of people of color in this country. And so the best thing you can do is sit with that and say, maybe this will give me a little bit more empathy. Maybe this is what it's like to be tailed around a store by security as a 13-year-old kid. That must have been uncomfortable. Maybe this is what it's like to be passed over for a job by someone who was white. That must have been uncomfortable. So me sitting here saying the wrong thing to someone, that's uncomfortable, but you'll survive. You'll survive, and we'll be better for it. How do you process when you find yourself feeling hatred? I try not to use the word hate. It's like just a thing I try and do. I try not to say like, oh, I hate that game, or I hate that website. I don't say hate. Because I really think it's sort of an easy word that means something much, much more strong and intense than what you mean. And I think if we treat hatred and the word hate as a taboo, then it's a lot easier to understand and to see it when it actually exists. When I feel hatred, I return to Unitarian Universalism. I really do. What does my faith call me to feel or think about this person that has really got my goat? And they call me to, it calls me to respect the inherent worth and dignity of that person. I don't have to like them. I don't have to love them, but I do have to respect them. It calls me to recognize that they are on their own journey of spiritual growth, and I should honor that that journey is, we are all in the process of becoming something different than where we are. And it calls me to rise above. Not much else you can do. Just try. I'm looking at the time. I think we probably only have time for one or two more. Really curious who wrote this. Talk about process theology. How does it influence your view of the divine? Process theology, this is really interesting. Process theology, in many ways, is the theology of Unitarian Universalism, I would say. And it is the notion that God or the divine is ever present, ever changing. It is not static. It changes and it morphs and it moves and it exists between us and it exists everywhere, in all things. And I find process theology to be incredibly moving. And one of the few things I read in seminary, I was like, oh, that's what I believe. Without condition, without needing to fix it for you beliefs. Process theology, the notion that God is ever-present and ever-changing. And to pin it down, to pin down the divine, to try and define it, to try and label it, to try and even to try and harness it or grab hold of it is a Sisyphean task. So don't. Lean into the wonder, lean into the mystery, lean into the fact that it can't be understood, it can't be defined, it can't be contained. So that's process theology. And one So I really don't have time to do the whole thing, but someone asked me at the first one about if I was a judge and someone committed a heinous crime, they admitted guilt, what would my action be? And I felt it was important because this is a part of myself that haven't yet had the chance to share with all of you. But I don't believe in prison. I'm a prison abolitionist. I don't believe in jails. I don't believe in detention. I don't believe in prisons. Even everyone immediately goes like, but what about the worst of the worst? Even for the worst of the worst. I don't think it works. And I worked at a prison. I worked at a prison for 2 years, the Bedford Hills Women's Correctional Facility in New York. It's a maximum security prison just outside of Manhattan. And the people I met there and the people I got to know there, two things. Should I tell the story about the breaking the covenant? When I started getting involved at the prison because Union offered a combined class. So half of the students were made up of Union students. It was taught by a Union professor. And the other half were made up of women and people from inside the prison. I say women and people because not everybody there identifies as a woman who's incarcerated there. And as part of the college program, because the prison had a college program, which was really cool. And we made an agreement, the first class I took there, the combined class, that we wouldn't look up the other students from the prison because all that information is publicly available. They couldn't look us up, and so we shouldn't be able to look us up. Halfway through the semester, I broke that. I looked them up. We had been working together side by side for a couple weeks, a couple months, and I was like, I know you. You are interesting and amazing and smart and funny, and why are you here? And because they murdered people. That's usually why you end up in maximum security prison, because you murdered people, and not like the gun accidentally went off or you hit someone and you fled the scene, like intentional murder, plan, premeditated murder. And I had to reckon with what this meant. And two things occurred to me. One, what happened in your life? What happened to you to put murder on the table? My life was so far removed from any path that would have put murder on the table. No seed had ever been planted where that was an acceptable way to deal with a problem. What happened? What happened? Because I don't believe that you came out that way. Something unfair happened, because here I am. That's not on the menu for me, but it was for you. And that's privilege. And the other thing I had to reckon with was, what would it feel like to spend the rest of my life repenting for the worst day of my life? Who was I on the worst day of my life when I behaved the worst I've ever behaved? What would it be like to be stuck in that point in time for the foreseeable future? And I believed that the people that I met there were more than they were, the person they were on the worst day of their life. They were better than they were on the worst day of their life. And I think that's true for all of us, and I think that's true for people in prison. If I can afford all of you that space, I should afford them that space. And if I want to be afforded that, then I need to afford it to them. So, if I was the judge and they admitted guilt, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know much about it, but I'd put them into a diversion program. I would figure out a way to reroute their life, to give them the support that wasn't there, to give them the education, to give them the job training, to give them the mental health support, the counseling, to free them from whatever it was that led them to that moment. But I wouldn't sentence them to prison. And it's a heavy note to end on, but a worthwhile one. Thank you.